Hello and welcome to Way Too Twog's Bagpipe and History Podcast, where I, your host, Jeremy Kingsbury, explores the likely repertoire of 18th and early 19th century bagpipers. Let's enjoy some music. This week's episode, I want to get back to playing through George MacLeod's repertoire. So it's very much a part two that's going to pick up kind of referencing the things that we talked about in part one, which is several episodes back now. So if you haven't listened to part one, go and give that a listen. I want to start with like corrections and omissions is maybe too strong a word, but corrections anyway. First one, I pronounced Lady Weems Jig wrong. I called it Whimsies or Wemyses. Thanks to Pete Stewart for pointing this out, but yeah, Lady Weems Jig. Because of course, why not? Certainly not the only thing I have and will pronounce wrong, so thanks folks for correcting my pronunciation on these things. I'm pretty nervous sometimes about being the more accessible version of a discussion of these tunes, and my ignorance on pronunciation setting a bad precedent for folks. So yeah, anyway, Lady Weems Jig, please keep correcting me if I pronounce something wrong. Maybe we'll get a new sting for corrections and omissions. Anyway, the other big thing that I did speak wrong about is the convention of when you mark something as being sharp, flat, or natural when it's outside of the key signature. My understanding of it, based on looking at Patrick MacDonald, was that once you marked it, it kind of, that marked it for the rest of the phrase, like for the rest of the line. The convention, thank you to Andrew O'Sullivan, John Charles Beauchatz, Stephen McNally, Rod Nevin, all these folks for kind of pointing out, like, no, the convention is just to the end of the measure. So I had that wrong. John Charles actually corrected me on that before the episode came out when we were talking about it, and I just didn't even, you know, process what he said. But yeah, it's within the measure. And so that makes my interpretation a little bit less, not less correct, but less 100%, I guess. Like, there's certainly room for a different take on what George MacLeod was doing. What I will say, especially thanks to kind of talking with Rod and realizing the issues with this manuscript, is Patrick MacDonald was inconsistent. Patrick had a very good understanding of you know, the conventions of written music, and, you know, of course he mentions how challenging it is to use the written music conventions to capture this music, but yeah, he's inconsistent with what he does. So the first tune, tune two, which is Lady Weems Jig, Patrick marks every single G as sharp except for one, which he marks as natural. It all makes sense in terms of like the convention of the time, because all of the G's that he's marking sharp are within their own measure. So there's never two G's in the same measure. But it's unnecessary for him to mark that one G as being natural. It makes sense that every single other G is sharp, so maybe this one he's trying to draw attention to. But based on what Rod was saying, the norm is just like, composers are generally consistent, so it's fine if he would mark the return to natural here, but generally, like, composers who do that generally do it all the time, if I'm understanding what Rod said correctly, and Patrick MacDonald doesn't do it all the time. So tune four, he has one G sharp mentioned that's outside of key signature, and then he never marks any of the others, and it seems like that's just returning to G natural sounds better in that tune anyway. And so the big question, though, is, you know, Lord Raye's Jig. This is where my big woohoo moment came from, of thinking that I had found some cool new way of playing. And now, like, understanding what the convention is, I mean, honestly, either way, it's not quite right. But I think I was influenced from looking at Patrick MacDonald, and especially tune two, Lady Weems Jig, where he marks every single note if it's going to be sharp or flat. I think looking at Lady Weems Jig and then looking at tune 6 and tune 24, which are the two different settings for Lord Raye's Jig, is sort of where I got the idea that that there's an F sharp and then an F natural. Tune 6 and tune 24 are weird, right? These are the ones that are in C major, so it has no sharps or flats marked. So technically then that one F sharp would be you know, the out. The thing is, in both times, both of the settings, where he marks one F sharp and the other he doesn't mark, they're within the same measure. So it's conceivable. And like tune 24 especially is where it gets tricky, where he is marking every single sharp. He marks a lot of F sharps in the second part of tune 24. There's one F that he doesn't mark sharp. That is within the same measure as the previous one that's marked sharp. So yes, based on the conventions of the day, probably or plausibly, Patrick meant that to be a sharp as well. I still think it is conceivable that he didn't, and I kind of don't care either way because it sounds musically interesting to me, and it is a approach to music that was new to me for like Highland piping, but certainly not unheard of for Inland piping and other musical things. And I actually have like a historical reason for wanting to do it as well, which we'll get into in a second here. But ultimately, this comes down to like my philosophy towards piping, which is that it was way more diverse prior to kind of the popularity of military piping and competitions. And like we can see that even in the tutorials, like in the 19th century, they have different fingering styles. The McCrimmon's supposedly, like this was sort of the thing you said about the different piping schools, is that they had a style of fingering all to themselves. You know, they had a unique way to get the notes out of the chanter. Barry Shears has talked about encountering that in Cape Breton. On the discussion post over there on the LBPS forum, Gordon Mooney talked about seeing a whole group of people in West Lothian playing on different, like having a different fingering style in his lifetime when he was going up there and playing some tunes. So like if you've got different, if people are using different fingering styles in order to make music, you're going to encounter these sharps and flats and like, you know, false fingerings that you can expand the notes. And based on like that encyclopedia entry of people exploring too much to try to expand the notes, like I just think this is completely plausibly a thing that pipers would do, if especially if they were trying to make themselves stand out as being the good piper. You know, you'd want to, if you're part of a court, there's that balance you want to do between playing everything perfectly like everybody would recognize it, and also in an express in an exciting new way that makes you distinctive. So I just think it is totally conceivable to me that my interpretation of George MacLeod playing around with F sharps and F naturals is what he was doing, and maybe even is what Patrick MacDonald is documenting here, because he's just somewhat inconsistent. But yeah, anyway, the historically rooted reasons for it too. So I think one of my favorite tunes to play from the William Vickers manuscript, you know, Vickers is, I think, a fiddle player from the borders. I think he's on the English side of the border. But lots of music that shows up in William Vickers manuscript is very popular pipe tunes. And at least once, and I think he has this someplace else too, but in this tune, Strike the Bell, that I've played rather a lot, Vickers has F natural or C naturals and C sharps, not right next to each other, but like within the same phrase, and it really musically does some really interesting things. I first competed with this tune. I competed with this tune for the like overseas entry for LBPS in 2021, I think. And I was using a D small pipe chanter, so it didn't matter to me. I didn't really pay that close of attention to what was going on. But since then, like, oh, hey, there's something cool going on here where he's marking the C naturals. You know, my first exposure to the tune was looking at Matt's setting for it in the Great Northern Tune Book. And, you know, Matt kind of follows the convention of, okay, in this part, Vickers mentions that the C is a natural, which is outside of the key signature. And then Vickers doesn't mark any of the others. That being said, I agree with Matt's interpretation here that a couple C naturals sound really good, and then switching over to C sharp. So anyway, I'm going to play it how Matt Seattle has it transcribed, which is just with one extra C natural than technically as written, but I think musically it works really well. Anyway, you can follow my link to look up the original on Farn if you don't have the Great Northern Tune Book, which is that, yeah, anyway, it's that archive site. The archive is sort of broken in that you can't have a stable URL to the information, but there's a stable URL for the JPEGs, for like the images of the manuscript. So anyway, you can follow that to look at the music. Here is Strike the Bell on my Lowland pipes in A. Yeah, lovely tune. Like I said, I'm pretty sure Vickers has another tune that does that. I can't find it. There's some other explanations possibly for what might be going on with the sharps and naturals right next to each other that Pete Stewart was talking to me about, but that went over my head and he gave me some things to look at, so I think we'll discuss that a little bit more in the future. Obviously a little bit different than my interpretation of what McLeod may have been doing, but still something in the realm of bouncing back and forth. It's one of the things I really love about Highland pipes and Lowland pipes is the ability to get that, you know, those extra notes through exploring different fingering styles. It's certainly one of the limitations of Scottish small pipes. And I think, you know, if the trajectory of Scottish small pipes really is, I don't actually know if the first Scottish small pipes had closed or open chanters, but certainly the Scottish small pipe tradition kind of morphs or grows into or splits and dies off as Northumbrian small pipes get popular. But there's a lot of keys on Northumbrian small pipe chanters eventually to expand your note possibilities. And of course, my Illan pipe chanter also has some false fingering possibilities, but well, a lot. Actually, but it also has keys at this point. So I wanted to show another kind of country dance tune, because I think this convention of going off the main core note or playing around with different fingerings and sharps and flats is definitely a thing I hear on Illan piping, and it's also a thing I see in country dance tunes. So anyway, here is a country dance tune called Simon Pure from the 1770s. This is from Johnson's 24 Country Dances for the year 1766. So this is on a very much keyed Illan pipe chanter to get it, but you can see what I'm talking about, of like exploring around with extra sharps and naturals and things to make really interesting music to me. And again, the type of music that would have been popular in George McLeod day and that he would have been exposed to. So anyway, here is Simon Pure. I'm not sure that this is really supporting any sort of an argument other than a straw man argument, but just popular music at the day that was country dance music played around with, you know, having different sharps and flats and things that are outside of the key signature to really complex musical approach. Here's another one. This is Stag Chase from Straight and Scullern. You know how I love a Straight and Scullern tune. We haven't played one in a while. So here's another country dance that plays around with some sharps and flats. Thank you. A couple episodes back, I talked about Ross Anderson's passing and that I was indebted to Ross for lots of things, but in particular Sutherland's manuscript and lots of David Young stuff. Sutherland's manuscript was the first collection of, you know, Scottish pipe music, specifically Scottish pipes music, because Sutherland played pastoral pipes and Highland pipes and maybe Lowland pipes of some sort, or Northumbrian small pipes as well. Hard to know exactly. But in Sutherland's manuscript, you see a lot of country dance tunes. And one of the things I really loved about putting out this episode and all that robust discussion on LBPS is I heard about a bagpipe tutor that I had completely missed. I'd missed its existence. Published in 1818, it was called The Bagpipe Preceptor, the art of playing the Great Highland Bagpipe rendered perfectly easy to every capacity. Interesting thing about The Bagpipe Preceptor is that, like, similar to how Sutherland puts Highland piping, The Bagpipe Preceptor book starts it on C, or down on D, so kind of where we're used to seeing, used to where we are seeing Inland pipe music start, but certainly not where we are used to seeing Highland pipe music, right? And again, it's got some different fingering than we are used to today as kind of the norm or the standard. And what's really exciting to me is it includes a discussion of the high E in this case, because he's got the notes different than how we would say today, but essentially he has the pinched up note as one of his examples. Anyway, so Sutherland having country dance music in his collection is not super helpful for, like, making a real strong argument that Highland pipe music did that or played country dance music necessarily. Of course, this is a silly straw man argument I'm making now, because Patrick MacDonald calls this country dances, right? Highland country dances is what this part of the book is called that George MacLeod's setting is in. But, you know, the tunes don't necessarily feel like country dance tunes to me as much as they feel like, you know, Highland or border music. But in the Bagpipe Preceptor, there is a country dance tune, like, in terms of here's this tutor that's going to teach you how to play and what, like, the important bagpipe tunes are and music you can play. It's got a country dance tune called Taste Life's Glad Moments, but it sounds like this stuff that I've been playing as, like, demonstration. So anyway, here is Taste Life's Glad Moments performed on Scottish small pipes, just to hear it. Love that. I feel like I experience it most often in country dance tunes, but definitely see it other places as well. Obviously, like, that's what all music is tension and release, but I love that use of tension and release at the end of the second part, the part where it's dee da 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 ja da da tro da da tro da. I just love that resolution, you know? But again, to me, like, I know these are really different things than the F sharp and F natural thing, but that playing around with the right note, the wrong note, the right note, the wrong note for musical interest is kind of how this all is working in my head as somewhat relevant. And I guess that brings us to the last correction or omission or just, you know, thing I should clarify. And that is that yes, explicitly in the preface, right, Patrick MacDonald says that he doesn't say that all these tunes are from a piper. He just says most of them are. And this is leads a lot of people to kind of looking through and try to figure out which tunes aren't from a bagpiper. And they often pick Lord Ray's Jig and the tune with a high B in it, saying this is not a thing that Highland pipers can do. But it is a thing that Highland pipers can do. I have done it on Highland pipes, and I think it is important to remember that older chanters are better at hitting not only high Bs, but also C naturals and F naturals. It seems like older chanters are better at that. They're easier to read to accomplish that anyway. I remember asking Chris Apps to make a read, and I said it was important to me that it be able to do C naturals, F naturals, and I wanted it to pinch up to B on this 100-plus-year-old chanter, and that was his comment, was older chanters, it is much easier to do that. So anyway, let's get back to what I am calling George MacLeod's repertoire, even though, yes, it is likely some of these tunes in here, maybe Patrick MacDonald didn't get from George MacLeod. So let's start with tune number 7, which is generally known as the Goat Herd. So here's Patrick MacDonald's setting for tune 7, or the Goat Herd. This is playing it pretty close to how it is marked with grace notes. So there's lots of trills, honestly. And then when he does single grace notes, again, they always come from below, which feels like worth pointing out again after re-listening to that conversation with Barry. But oftentimes, so yeah, the grace notes always come from below the note that it's going to land at. And oftentimes, like last time we played through the stuff, it's like something else is going on, I think, in terms of how to interpret it, because it is just like it'll be a C and then a C grace note into a D. Like there's an echo, echoing grace note rather than a real grace note. So anyway, that is what the music says, and I'm playing it pretty close to Ezra. This episode is sort of like a callback to the old days, and I don't know why it happened with Goat Herd, but I wound up doing a deep dive into Goat Herd and kind of playing through different settings for it. So if this is, you know, collected in the mid-18th century, the next version that I found for Highland Pipes for the Goat Herd comes from Donald MacDonald's Light Dance or Light Music book from 1828-ish. Anyway, here is his setting for the Goat Herd. Lots of grips, and it's like one of those questions where I'm not sure if it's a grip or a tarlua based on how Donald MacDonald wrote it. Trying to play it about as close as I can to, I'm trying to be more intentional of copying the gracing as written, but you know, again, if you're doing this, remember, you can play it however the heck you want. And I think it's interesting to look at the gracing, but, you know, remember what Barry said, people that play this music and aren't competing, back in the olden times when they're trying to entertain folks in a community, play it how they feel like playing it at the time. And that's a okay way. And I think a good way to approach this music. Anyway, here is Donald McDonald setting for the Goat Herd. So the next one I have is William Gunn's version of it from around 1848. William Gunn, these have all had the Gaelic names, by the way, and later editions of Donald MacDonald include the English Goat Herd, but the version I'm linking in National Library of Scotland just has it in Gaelic. William Gunn has it in Gaelic and in English as the Goat and Sheep Herd. William Gunn is one of these collections of tunes that I just keep on not doing. It's another episode that I have started, maybe a third of the way through. It's a collection of music that I forget about. I always think of the Highland Bagpipe tune books as like Donald MacDonald, then Angus MacKay, but William Gunn is in there between those two, much closer to Angus MacKay than Donald MacDonald. That's published in 1848-ish, although I think I've also seen an earlier date. I really need to spend more time looking at Roddy Cannon's bagpipe book bibliography. Anyway, here is The Goat and Sheep Herd from William Gunn. William Gunn has a very, maybe not distinctive, but he has a way of, he has a lot of gracing, and I am not following, this is the one I'm following not quite as closely as I've been trying to before, but definitely a version of music that's really worth looking at. There's a lot of the kind of G, D, E, grace note kind of repetition going throughout. Anyway, here is The Goat and Sheep Herd from William Gunn. Wild. I love those little high A endings. And also, did you catch it? Because I didn't catch it until just listening back to it. It's totally got Larry Grogan or Coppers and Brass in there too. The second to last part very much has like that Coppers and Brass thing. that is basically exactly the same as James Aird's setting for Larry Grogan, which, you know, is Coppers and Brass. Anyway, it was a delight to all of a sudden notice that in there. And it's, as far as I can tell, it's the only one that does it. David Glenn's setting gets a little wild. David Glenn maybe has that too, but let's not get out of order. Let's look at Angus MacKay and see if he also has some recognizable bits in there. I don't think it does. This is the Goat Herd from Angus MacKay, printed around 1854. Yeah, so once again, we have the Coppers and Brass or Larry Grogan part there. Angus MacKay just kind of switched the order. I also like how MacKay's setting doesn't have the same like high A ending that we get with William Gunn, but he also doesn't, he keeps everything as an eighth note towards the end of the phrasing. Anyway, let's look at Glenn's setting. This is one of the more complicated ones and definitely gets to be pretty cool. 1876-ish this is the Goat Herd from David Glenn, and David Glenn doesn't have the Gaelic, just has the note. Interestingly, you know, we spent a lot of time talking about key signatures. David Glenn uses key signatures, but it's sort of weird. He has an F sharp and a C sharp, and then he marks that there's a G natural, which I guess that's how he's communicating like the flat seventh or something. But yeah, if you're keeping tally, Angus MacKay didn't bother with key signatures, neither did William Gunn. And as we've talked about, I think we've talked about before, Donald MacDonald doesn't either. Interestingly too, well, this is sidetrack, but the key signatures in the bagpipe preceptor is an interesting thing, as you can imagine, since it has all these tunes starting down on D, but we'll talk about that when we get to the bagpipe preceptor episode. Anyway, here is David Glenn's setting for the Goat Herd. What a wild setting. I really like that. The David Glenn ones have a tendency to put very hard to read repeats and kind of phrases in there. But yeah, really interesting musical things going on there. I like the combination of the high A's and just good stuff. I feel so indebted to the Glenns, and just getting a little confused here quickly. I definitely feel like I need to either do a deep dive or get somebody else to. But I think if I'm right, David Glenn is like cousin to John Glenn, which is whose collection makes up so much of the music stuff at the National Library of Scotland that's been digitized. I think that's how it works. So it says these are selected items from the collection of John Glenn from 1833 to 1904. I'm looking at this cool website, the Bagpipe Place Museum. It's got John Glenn as being the son of Thomas Glenn, born in 1833, right? And Thomas was, brother to George and Alexander Glenn. Alexander Glenn is the grandfather of David Glenn. Great-grandfather? Anyway, they're related. They're kin, anyway. But lots of really cool music in the National Library of Scotland. That's, like, how I've been able to find and explore so many tunes. And also, the David Glenn has a pretty stellar music book of his own, which I play from seldomly. The other source I've been using a lot for kind of doing this exploration of the goat herd, I've talked about Kilshan before, but, Kilshan is just so great for stuff that doesn't show up on traditional tune archive or doesn't show up in the National Library of Scotland. If it's really bagpipe centric, Highland bagpipe centric, it's almost certainly on Kilshan, and you can search by, index. So you can alphabetical look through all of these different collections, which is just such a amazing resource. But it had me thinking, because it is such a good resource, and when I was poking around some of these collections, I saw Lord Ray's jig. I'm just kind of curious, how often does Lord Ray's jig show up? Because, like I said, many people, when looking at this repertoire of Alexander MacLeod, they're trying to figure out, like, which are the tunes that aren't Highland pipe tunes. And we've got Lord Ray's from the Edinburgh collection, Lord Ray's jig from Gunn. So the Edinburgh collection, that's David Glenn. David Glenn's collection has a setting for Lord Ray's jig, and so does William Gunn. And what about this Lord Ray's fencibles business? Different tune. But anyway, so it's not all over the place, but Lord Ray's jig does show up in, 1840s Highland bagpipe collection. So the idea that that a piper wouldn't have played Lord Ray's jig, that there's two settings for in Patrick MacDonald seems unlikely to me. And the fact that those two settings are so far apart from another, like, I kind of believe that maybe one setting wasn't from a Highland piper, but, like, why include two? Unless it's just a mistake. Maybe Patrick MacDonald just, it slipped past him, because they weren't right next to each other either, right? It's, like, tune six and the last tune 20... Yeah, Lord Ray's jig is tune 6 and tune 24 in the book. Anyway, I am rambling. Anyway, that's been our goat herd exploration. Let's get back into George MacLeod's manuscript. This next tune is tune 8, also known as Spoigan. And in terms of, like, trying to figure out which tunes don't fit, I think, Spoigan is definitely a tune that works on pipes, and I feel like I've seen it other places as well. Interestingly, it's one of the very few tunes in this collection that has no gracing indicated on it at all. To me, that's more the one that stands out as being a little eccentric, that there's no embellishments anywhere, because that's one of the cool things about Patrick MacDonald's collection, right, is that we get grace notes in there. There's some communication of, like, what a Highland piper would have been doing with it. So anyway, here is the Patrick MacDonald setting for Spoigan, or tune 8. Thank you. So using that Kill Shaun tool of looking up the master index, I couldn't find any other settings in Highland Pipes for Spoigen, but using my other favorite tool, Traditional Tune Archive, I found one in a country dance collection that I haven't looked at before, or at least I haven't looked at in a long time. It looks vaguely familiar, like so many of these do, but it's got a great title. It's called A Choice Collection. I love it. The various like descriptors that they added to these 18th century tune collections. So anyway, this is A Choice Collection of Scots Reels or Country Dances and Stress Bays with a bass, etc. From Edinburgh. This is printed and sold by Robert Ross. And it seems like it's from 1774-ish, 1804, something along those lines. But yeah, so there's a setting for Spoigen in here. This looks like exactly the type of collection that I would have ignored because of key signature woes. It's got Spoigen, but it's got Spoigen in the key of F. So I'll play it for you on F, but this collection, I'm just saying this now so I remember to get back to it. There's a lot of things in key signatures that would have been red flag ignores for me in the past, but there's also a Tibby Fowler of the Glen with variations. It's not, I can't tell quite if it's a variation set, but it's 1, 2, 3, 4. It's 4 parts. So, you know, Tibby Fowler is one of those tunes where my interpretation of it is, I think it's good and I think it's sound music and I enjoy it, but, there's definitely, it's a little bit more minor sounding than the way I've been playing it and adjusting it, but I wrote a bunch of variations for it and yeah, now I see that people have done that before me, of course. So, yeah, looking forward to revisiting this collection. Anyway, here is Spoigen in the key of F on an S on a tweaked Jerry Freeman low F whistle. Well, yes, I couldn't find any settings for Spoigen. If I had used the other really important resource, you know, the new edited version of Patrick MacDonald, which did a good job of kind of condensing all of the various discussion threads and back issues, which I think I talked about last time, this kind of discussion about what all these tunes are. Anyway, there's another name for the tune that does show up in William Gunn as The Inundation, again with a Gaelic name as well, but here it is. This is The Inundation on Small Pipes. Interestingly, the next tune is on the page before this, also in William Gunn. So anyway, here is William Gunn setting for The Inundation, and then we'll move on to the next tune, which also shows up in William Gunn. We're having a little William Gunn fest. Anyway, The Inundation. Thank you. Yeah, very cool. Very lovely tune. Okay, let's get on to the next one. This one is a little less clear, kind of where it comes from, what it might be. This is the Stable Boys or the Drover Lads, maybe. The Drover Lads, that's what I'm going to play on William Gunn. But anyway, here is the tune. The interesting thing about this tune, when I played through it on small pipes in A, I really didn't like the way it sounded and felt like I needed to make some adjustments. So something about the way the C sharps worked on the A small pipe chanter was what really was bothering me. But on Highland pipes, I think it sounds great. So anyway, here is 2-9 from Patrick MacDonald, and we'll see kind of what it might be also in William Gunn in a second. Anyway, 2-9. Well, I guess as you can hear, I still didn't really know where to end it. You know, it felt like I needed some resolution at the end, and I never quite got it. Anyway, the notes on this tune are a little bit less clear of, like, not sure what that is or where you can find a concordance or an actual name for it. Because remember, all of these tunes, the reason I'm exploring all this stuff, if you don't remember, is, like, all of these tunes in the North Highland Country Dance section, there's no names for them. Everything is just tune numbers. So trying to, like, piece out what the other names are can be a little bit tricky, but thankfully people have figured that out and shows up in the footnotes. This tune, well, anyway, so this one is a little bit, like, unclear what it is. The notes suggest the Drover Lads or possibly the Stable Boys, which is another name for Lady Weems' tune. So I don't see Stable Boys in it, but looking at the Drover Lads, I can kind of hear it. And the cool thing about it is William Gunn does a variation set of, not a variation set, but he has the Drover Lads with variations, and it translates to a pretty cool tune. So anyway, here is William Gunn's setting for the Drover Lads, which has the same similar vibe to what we just heard as 2-9 anyway. I'm delighted to get to spend so much time with Gunn. Yeah, interesting collection, interesting musical choices, and lots of really stellar tunes. Yeah. And it just, you know, every time I see so much of the stuff that shows up in James Aird is just like note for note lifted from Patrick MacDonald. It's cool to see William Gunn is doing something else. The interesting thing about Gunn is he's sort of usable because somebody has ABC notationed him and put him up on traditional tune archive. But it's weird looking at it because it's, you know, it's William Gunn, but without any embellishments. And it makes you think, oh, he must not have done embellishments. But you got to look at the original because he put a lot of embellishments on his music. Anyway, this next one, Tune 10, I'm pretty proud of because I found the connection for it, or I found the concordance. So Tune 10 is, you know, in the notes, it mentions that, hey, we found there's another version of this in Aird. But again, like I said, a lot of this music is just note for note copied into Aird. Lots of Patrick MacDonald shows up in later Aird editions. And so, you know, I've had this tune on the podcast a bunch. Brecha Heimbel plays it as Aird's jig. And this version has three parts. Aird only has two, I believe. And regardless, I found it with an actual title, which is The Unfortunate Jock, I think, from David Young. So anyway, here is Tune 10 as written. Again, we've got some trills and some grace notes. Again, like with the notes are kind of leading up, you know, the grace note is coming from below to the top of it, with the exception of these trills, obviously. So anyway, interesting stuff here. A lot of C echo grace note markings. But anyway, here is Tune 10, or The Unfortunate Jock. And even though we just had it on the podcast two episodes ago, here is The Unfortunate Jock from David Young. It's actually just a two-part version of it rather than the three-part that Patrick MacDonald has, but clearly the same tune and sounds just lovely on my quiet pipe or small pipe. So anyway, here it is. Such a lovely tune. All right, Tune 10 is Behind the Bush in the Garden, probably. Here is Patrick MacDonald setting for it. Again, probably coming from George MacLeod. I feel like I'm just kind of throwing names and stuff at you, so sorry. To ground us one more time, remember David Young, that manuscript comes from 1737. Patrick MacDonald publishes this collection in 1784 and probably collected these tunes a little bit earlier than that. And anyway, like I said, works best as straight from part one. Here is tune number 10. In terms of gracing, again, same convention. The grace notes are either trills or they are single notes that come from beneath the note that it's landing on. And often they are just echoes. We get like the C, another one of these C echoey grace notes. So anyway, here is Behind the Bush in the Garden from Patrick MacDonald Settings. And it's only right to do the William Gunn setting, right? Since we've been talking about it all this time. So anyway, here is William Gunn setting for Behind the Bush in the Garden. Cool tune. Well, once again, we didn't quite finish the collection of 24 tunes that are likely the repertoire of George MacLeod's piping styles from way up north there that Patrick MacDonald listened to when he was growing up and went back while putting this book together. But I think tune 12 is a really great place to leave off because it does another thing. It's another one of these tunes that people who are looking for an excuse to say, well, that one's probably not a Highland pipe tune, they'll make kind of assumptions based on what the convention of piping is today. And that is tune 12 has a high B in it, and a pretty lovely one that's sort of easy to play because it's nestled between two high A's, which is kind of the easiest high A to do. I do some weird stuff in the setting just because I'm not quite sure what exactly he's getting at. There's these holds. Next time we pick up, there's a couple weird things. I don't know what Patrick MacDonald is doing when he's writing this down, especially as it relates to a Highland Piper. There's some holds between notes, and I don't know if that means there's, like, between two eighth notes, if there's a hold, I would just play that as a quarter note without breaking it up. But I'm not sure that musically that sounds particularly good, but as I'm playing through this tune to kind of finish up the episode, you'll hear me do that, I think, on the second time through. But yeah, it is a high B tune. It's got gracing in it the same way that the tunes that have grace notes in them in this section, which is, like I say, I think all of them except Spoigen, at least all of them so far, except for Spoigen or the Inundation. It's got the same convention of gracing, where the grace notes are always appearing lower than the next note, and they're often echoes. So in here you'll hear an A grace note, so it's you know, three A's, it's eighth notes, and then an A grace note into a high A. Not a lot of grace notes, but that, and then there's a couple trills as well. So anyway, but listen for the high B. In terms of what this tune might be, Angus MacKay has a setting for the Grey Buck that kind of sounds like this, but not really. And also, I'm out of time, so I'm not going to record it. But you can go poke around trying to figure out what else this tune might be called. Maybe it's the Grey Buck, maybe it's not. Anyway, thanks y'all for listening. If you want to support the podcast, you can go over to patreon.com/waytotwog, where I've got bonus episodes and all sorts of stuff. And yeah, if you want to talk about the episode, you know, comment wherever I'm posting them. I know I share them around in a lot of various places, but LBPS seems to get the most amount of people having some thoughts and sharing some pretty amazing information. So big thanks to everybody who's adding comments and discussion on that LBPS forum. So it's a Facebook page, but it's called the LBPS forum as opposed to just the LBPS main Facebook site that only the admins can post to. Anyway, cheers everyone. Here is Patrick McDonald's High B tune nestled into a bunch of other Highland Pipe tunes, likely the repertoire of his childhood bagpiper, George MacLeod. So anyway, cheers everyone.